Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore and our favorite video games. I'm your host, Joe Perez, one of several lore-focused folks from Blizzard Watch, and I've got my diabolic co-host with me today, Matt Rossi. How you doing today, Matt?
I'm doing good.
Today we are going to be answering some of your questions. We finished the Diablo series, as far as Diablo 4 goes, and now it's time to take some of your questions that you have been giving us over the last several weeks. If you have questions for this or any of our podcasts, be sure to send those in to podcast@blizzardwatch.com. Specify the show it's for. If you don't want to send us an email, you can hit us up on Discord. We have one set aside for everyone, which is the Q&A Podcast Questions channel. And if you are a Patreon supporter, as a way of saying thank you, and we kind of look there first. After all, you help keep the lights on. It's the Patreon Q&A Podcast Questions channel. Again, specify what show it's for. I'd say tweet at us, but I believe we are currently in the heat death stage of Twitter, so that your results may vary or be inconsistent. So stick with the emails or Discord. First up, we have a question from Dai Kaiju. Is the Eternal Conflict just the original Anu trying to pull itself back together? That is a very good question, since, we talked about this a little bit before. Anu was the perfect being that existed when the universe was new, essentially, in Diablo. Wanting to make itself more perfect, it split itself in twain into the Diamond Warrior and Tathamet, a seven-headed demon dragon thing. And the conflict ensued, as conflict does when you divide yourself into that, which created the sanctuary from the crystal arch and spine from the body of Anu, and then the burning hells, which happened to be from the body of Tathamet, the seven greater evils, the three prime and three lessers, all are said to be heads or aspects of the seven heads of Tathamet. But there is this thing. Do we think that, you know, this eternal conflict, this eternal collision towards each other, is Anu trying to reconstitute itself? Matt, what do you think?
No, I do not.
Okay.
What I think is going on is a lot more complicated than just trying to stitch itself back together. For starters, first thing I'm going to throw out you there is, what was Anu? Like, we don't actually know anything more than the most general, vague answer to that question. Anu was an entity that existed before the entire creation of everything we see in the Diablo series. Anu existed in a place that was not any place we've got, because all the places we've got were born out of Anu's death. Anu chose to remove from itself everything it considered negative, and what was left, we call the Diamond Warrior, but we don't even know what the Diamond Warrior looked like other than a few sketches in like the Book of Cain or what have you, that sort of show like a little tiny like armored diamond figure up against this vast Tathamet figure. And we don't know, like, when you're asking, is this Anu's attempt to reconstitute itself? We don't even know if Anu wants to or needs to reconstitute itself. One of the things I've been thinking about is a line that said, if you're playing a necromancer in D4, and thanks to Liz Harper, our EIC, for pointing this one out to me, and it's had me thinking ever since, where Rathma is said to have said to another necromancer that he saw death as a transformation. We know that Rathma, before he was Rathma, was Lunarian, the child of Lilith and Inarius, and as such, the first of the Nephilim. As the first of the Nephilim, he was the first being to contain within himself good and evil, you know, positive and negative emotions, since Anu itself, because we don't even know if Anu had a gender, or if it had all genders at once. It's really not something we can really talk about. So I think about this every time I think about the fact that at the moment that the World Stone, the Eye of Anu, was used to create Sanctuary, as wielded by an angel and a demon together, Tragul, the spirit of balance, entered the world of Sanctuary, and they didn't notice it. They were making the world with the World Stone, and they didn't notice Tragul entering it. How is that possible?
I mean, virtually impossible, right?
Yeah, but what if, and here's another thing, what if the reason we don't see Tragul in Diablo 4 is because he's dead? I remember death is a transformation, and he died at a very specific time. All along, I think that Anu has never sought to become back to what it was. That has never been Anu's goal. Anu wants to transform. That's the whole point of what it did originally. It's presented to us as Anu took away everything that was corrupt and foul and hurled it aside. But what if it's not that simple? What if it's not as easy as everything good and pure went into this one and everything corrupt and foul went into this one, but also everything rigid and orderly went over here and everything chaotic and uncontrollable went over here. There's more to this whole thing than just good and evil. There's more to it than law and order versus chaos and randomness, but those elements are all there. And that's on purpose. That's by design. Anu wanted to be separate. And it wanted to be more than it was. Joe uses the term to be more perfect. But what is perfection to an entity that once existed as a single point, a single place in existence, which was everything? And it decided, this is insufficient. It's like an artist who wants to fill a page. You got a blank page, wants to fill it, right? That's the artistic impulse. You want to put something down. I think the reason that Rathma views death as a transformation is because Tragul told him about the transformation of his own death when it happened, and it happened when Tyriel killed him, when he blew up the World Stone, which was the Eye of Anu, which was Tragul.
Yeah, and you know, so that makes a lot of sense, right?
Yeah. In so doing, he made Anu more perfect. Because perfect doesn't just mean flawless. Perfect also means finished, final, the end. You don't get to be perfect until you are done.
But with that same right, then, wouldn't that also necessitate the destruction potentially of all that is the high heavens and all that is the burning hells?
Yes, it would, wouldn't it?
Which would be fueled by the eternal conflict and the eternal desire to destroy that?
Or would be fueled by the creation of beings that could destroy them.
Yeah, because the Nephilim can destroy them.
Yeah,
we've seen
just one Nephilim, if you played just Diablo 3 as a campaign, one Nephilim managed to stand up and take out Diablo with the power of all of the evils, and then as a follow-up, an Archangel with the power of all of the evils. So as Tyriel says, he can defeat, you know, or she can defeat, in that case, my character, they can defeat the greatest champions of heaven and hell alike. But still within that heart beats a mortal chest. And it is that dichotomy that makes humanity far more than just the playthings that the devils seem to think we are and the nothing, you know, mindless muck that the angels think we are. Like, there's a whole element in this story about how eventually, like, Lilith saw in humanity what she wanted to see, what she was able to see as a demon. She wasn't able to look at them and see all of it because she doesn't really possess half of it. And Inarius absolutely couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because he also lacks, the two of them together lack, but Lenarion, Rathma, could see it. And there's a reason as a Nephilim that he chose to teach Mendeln in the Sin War. And Mendeln got to keep his memories of the Sin War alone of all living people at that time.
Well, it's also interesting too, right? And I brought this up before that the angels and the demons, the prime evils, the lesser evils, the archangels, they're all emotions, right? They're all concepts. They're all things.
Emotions or concepts or ideals.
Yeah. Yeah. They're singular. They're singular in their sort of purpose. And when you get to the Nephilim are sort of the perfect combination of all of those things and then get context. Right. Because what is justice? Justice can mean a million things to a Nephilim, to a living being, to a human, which is still sort of the melding of those two things without the spark.
It's a Nephilim who doesn't quite know how to get the power yet.
Yeah.
It is still a Nephilim.
They're a Nephilim that the battery hasn't been turned on yet.
Yeah.
Right. So like in a way, Anu is sort of realized in the creation of the Nephilim as being the most perfect unit, right? Which is why,
the word perfect is one that has a lot of different meanings. In
example, I'm air quoting it, yeah.
No, but what you're talking about is exactly that. It's like, before there is all this stuff, what does perfect mean when everything is one thing? Sure, it's perfect because there's nothing else. There's nothing to compare it to. There's nothing to contrast with it. Whereas in order to get that context you're talking about, and it's a very good word to use, you have to take things away from the singular point of all admixture and distill them down. You have to take them away from each other so they can stand on their own and be contrasted to each other. So you give them that context. And in a way, the eternal conflict has always been a mindless battle, which is why the angels and demons began cracking and saying, this is ridiculous. It'll never end. As long as it was just them fighting it, it would never end.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, to quote, of all things, Futurama, perfectly symmetrical violence never solved anything. Like, if you're, the angels and the demons are perfectly symmetrical. There's no advantage either side has that the other side doesn't have a countervailing advantage in. Like, it may not be the same advantage, but wherever this side is weak, this side is strong, and vice versa. And it just means that no matter how many demons you pour at the problem, the angels are going to cut through them. No matter how many angels you put around Pandemonium Fortress, the devils are eventually going to overwhelm them. And it will just keep happening because they can't do anything else. They don't have the ability to do it. And that's why Lilith and Inarius and their little rebellion is so fascinating, because they're still angels and demons, but they did this thing. How did they do this? How did they become something other in this way? Something mentally other? And you're talking again, like the question, and I'm not running away from the question here. The question about, is this the eternal conflict just the original Anu trying to pull itself back together? No, this is the original Anu who is still Anu trying to push everything else forward. Not together, but forward. There's an evolutionary process here. Joe is exactly on the money with his talk about concepts and context. Because an idea, what's the old, I think it's Plato, but it's him writing from the perspective of Socrates. The unexamined life is not worth living. That old philosophical context. But you can't examine a thing unless you have a way to look at it from it. What is the true nature of evil? How can you know what the true nature of evil is if it's always just everything is inside you? You're trying to look at your own attributes. What is the true nature of good? What is the true nature of any of this? The only way to look at it, the only way to understand it, is to remove yourself from it. And in death, Anu has done that. Anu is now a complete outsider. that can look in on the whole cosmos and see all the stuff that used to be part of it and see how it works and what it does. And I think that the change in Lilith and in Arius and in others like them, the change in the demon lords even, and in the archangels, it is based on that idea that they are becoming more complex.
Mm-hmm.
The more they interact with humanity, the more that they have this, you know, this attempt to outmaneuver and outthink and do things that are not part of the original context of the eternal conflict, the more complex they get, the more complex the cosmos gets. And it is that complexity that is what Anu was always looking for. Anu wanted transformation. Anu has killed the universe several times now. The original universe before all this stuff was like a big white shell with just Anu in it. And then we got hell and heaven and pandemonium and the crystal arch and then sanctuary. And now sanctuary possibly has all sorts of little mini worlds within it because the worldstone fragments went everywhere. And the worldstone fragments are like are literally like seeds. Like when you seed a cloud, you know, when you fly through a cloud and you dump stuff in the clouds to get it to rain. Like you dump worldstone fragments on a world and they start growing more world. There's all these, you know, and that's another thing Joe pointed out. You guys should go back and listen to the Diablo thing we just did, because a lot of the stuff Joe was saying, I was literally sitting here going, okay, tack that away. Ooh, tack that away. Ooh, tack that away. Because all of it comes down to this idea of death as a transformation. This idea that Liz dropped goes so well with Joe's idea of context, because the transformation is the context. What Anu is a evolving narrative of itself. And we are, like our characters, the world of Sanctuary is that narrative.
Yeah, and you can see that too, like in little tiny touches, right? Like let's look at soul stones. Soul stones have to be attuned. They have to be attuned. Why do they have to be attuned? Especially soul stones that have already contained evils born of the same ilk, right? We just go through this in Diablo 4. Mild spoilers if you haven't completed the campaign. But I feel like we're far enough from release that's okay. You are literally using the tomb and essence of hatred to attune a new tomb, stone that housed an agent of hatred. Why do you have to do that? Why does the soulstone have to be attuned every time? Because to Matt's point, there's a constant evolution. They are evolving. They're changing. They're different. They're not the same as the way they were before. You can see this with Tyriel, who did not go back to the Crystal Arch when he got blown up. He managed to remanifest himself, essentially Dr. Manhattan style, but without the nuclear power. And that simple act, like, and I shouldn't even call it simple, but in that act, in that sort of denial of going through the same processes he went through before, he then changed what he is. He, like, that's sort of the whole root of Diablo 4, and that's sort of the root of all of the eternal conflict. It's all about change. It's all about tearing it down to build it back up. In death is rebirth, and you can't have rebirth until you die. And every time you die, you come back different. Andariel, we've killed Andariel. We've sent Andariel back to the Burning Hells. Andariel is wildly different than when we first dealt with her.
Yeah, because Andariel was like basically all about suffering, right? That's Andariel's thing, anguish, mm-hmm, mental mm-hmm. pain. But there's a difference. Like, how do you really feast on mental suffering when all you're fighting are angels who barely know what suffering is?
Mm-hmm.
And whose death means nothing to them because they'll just come back. And even if you torture them, like, yeah, okay, you can get some wring some suffering out of them then. But compare that to a human and all the ways humans can suffer. Like, Andariel would, like, that would have been a revelation to Andariel. Like, oh, wow, they're suffering here just because this person, like some other person they didn't even really know that well, died, and they're suffering. And I can feed on that. And imagine as Andariel is exposed to the reality of suffering, not the concept of suffering. It's like it's like a translation process, if you think about mm-hmm. it. It's like you're crossing a boundary, going from a two-dimensional being to a three-dimensional being who now knows, oh, all this stuff exists.
I mean, look at Diablo. Diablo, the titular character itself. How many evolutions has Diablo gone through?
Yeah, Diablo starts off as a big thug. essentially, who just likes to scare things. And he becomes a plotter, at least smart enough to pull one over on every other evil. And that's not, that's pretty impressive considering that Mephisto is one of those evils and Mephisto's a thinker.
Yeah.
You know, but Diablo managed it.
And Diablo has evolved, like, just kind of going through that brief history. In the first game, you descend into the crypts beneath the cathedral in Tristram. You find your way to Diablo. You kill Diablo. And what do? You shove him in a soul stone and then shove the soul stone in your brain. Diablo then starts sort of driving around in the mech suit a little bit.
Yeah, but think about that. Think about what you're saying. And think about, I know you know this. Uh-huh. I just want to make sure that you get it. Like it firmly in your head when you're thinking about it, what you are describing here
is a transformation.
Is it not just is it a transformation? It's like sure, it's really weird that Aiden did that, but think about what it was like for Diablo mm-hmm. to suddenly have a human's body and personality in his head. Like he goes off and he creates Leia with Adria. We know how he did it the old fashioned way. Do you think demons have a lot of consensual sex? Like, not to put too far apart on this or get us into any warnings, but think about the difference that is, the flavoring of that.
Well, I mean, even then, do demons care about procreation?
Well, we know that at least one did, and that's Mephisto did, and his children are not the same.
Correct.
They're not the same as the other demons. Lilith is capable of concepts that other demons are not. How is that possible? What is she? There is so much to this. And I love your illustration of using Diablo here. It's brilliant because what that game is, on one level, that game is us chasing after Diablo.
Yes.
Right? But on another level, that game is the adventures of Diablo and his weird sidekick.
Well, that's Mario. Diablo 2, right? Like we go like that, and that's where I'm kind of going with it. In Diablo 2, he lets Marius live, right? And we can argue that he understood that he would need him later. But why Marius? Why that particular human? He could have found any other human. Literally any. He in the romps of Diablo 2, there are so many other humans that die that he could have just plucked one and said, you want to live, go do this thing for me. But he chose Marius. Why? Was that some evolution and foresight into like the way humans are, knowing that Marius was the perfect emotional vessel for that? Because
Marius knows terror because he is afraid of everything. Marius knows hatred because he hates himself.
Yep.
And Marius absolutely knows destruction because he's destroying himself due to his own self-hatred.
Marius lies to himself constantly.
Yeah. He sins. You literally find him in an opium den.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Anguish and pain. You know, he's got both of those. And he isn't just, it's not just that he has those things. It's not like he doesn't just tick boxes. He experiences them in a way like Diablo doesn't know fear. He just uses fear. But once you put him in Aiden's body, he will at least know what Aiden knows of fear.
Mm-hmm.
He will know what it is to be mortal, even as he isn't. It's interesting to think about this, that all of this stuff, everything that happens to Sanctuary and everything that happens because of these forces is forced to change.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it goes back to what we were talking about. So yeah, you're definitely right on that.
Yeah. I just think it's interesting, and go back and if you play those games, if you read the books or read the synopsis, like just look at Diablo through that context and how Diablo has changed and evolved, and then start applying that to the other prime evils, right? Because we're dealing with that now in Diablo 4. Mephisto has absolutely evolved and changed their perspective on how the world works, or what its role in the world is. And I think that's going to be something that we need to watch moving forward with future expansions and future content as well. So getting back to the root of the question, is the eternal conflict just Anu trying to pull itself back together? No, it's Anu trying to pull itself apart because
I mean, pull itself apart's a little mean. But that is, you can't make something until you have the parts.
Yes.
You know, and I think Anu wants to make a thing, and we're seeing here is the constant painful iteration process of making a world. Like, the reason that the World Stone didn't just go around making worlds willy-nilly was because making a world is hard, and it requires something from both sides. You can't think about trying to be a creator of things and not have arrogance and maybe a little spite and knowing anguish, and knowing these things is inherently part of using them. Like, art is all about emotion, right? So that's something to think about as we look at what Anu has done or is doing or maybe did, is that Anu looked at the existence and saw it was empty, and its first act was to rip itself apart and fling its heart, you know, out into the void of everything.
Fair.
So there's something to be said for this. I do like the idea.
But hopefully that answers your question. But I know you have another question here. We're going to ask that one real quick, which is, how much is a gold coin really worth on Sanctuary? Bugs drop it. Bugs, Akarat's sake. Ret catchers must get their lunch money from just checking their traps. Money in Diablo is always a weird esoteric concept because it depends on what culture you're dealing with, what section of the world you're in, and what part of the hierarchy you're at. Gold has value because it is a precious coin and commodity, sure, but so do gems, so do items, so do generic bartering system. It kind of is as valuable as the spot you're in at that moment in time, if I understand my Diablo at all, which is to say, yes, sometimes you can find a couple pieces of gold inside of a bug or a rat or whatever, but that doesn't mean that it is still so prevalent that even the peasants have millions of gold that they can just spend on whatever they want. What was it that there was a description of inflation where it was, if the cost of bread is $1,000 because everybody has $1,000 to spend on bread, is there really any value in the $1,000 anymore?
I mean, the value of bread.
Exactly.
That's the thing about currency in general, is it is the reason that our characters get so much money is because the things we do with the money get ridiculously expensive as we get up in level. I mean, I'm sure you've noticed this. So in one way, it's a game mechanic. In another way, in lore, you don't have the 30 million gold that you have on your current character. If you're playing Diablo 4, you don't actually have that much money. It's just there to represent, you know, the cost of the things you're doing to your gear and the things you're doing with your stats. Like, when you respec your character, you don't actually hand gold to anyone. You know what I mean? Because it's like, I mean, you're respecing, you're just literally standing there in the town square for a little bit thinking about, well, I'd rather be able to throw lightning out of my hands. Maybe I don't want to, like, you know, make earthquakes as much. Maybe I'd rather be throwing lightning. Yeah, I'll throw lightning more often. You don't actually pay anybody for that. You know, this is just a game mechanical way to represent that. However, from a lore perspective, gold would probably vary greatly depending on where the heck you were. Like, think about it this way. 90% of humanity died 50 years ago. 90%. Whole nations have broken up. Look at the mess that Khajistan is. Like, its original capital city of Khorast is gone. No one even really knows where it is. I don't even think it's represented in the lands we get to see when we go to Khajistan. I think those are all too far north. And we've yet to see the south of Khajistan. So keep that in mind. But also, like, look at this. Like, Chaldeum is basically a monster-infested wasteland with a few holdout spots. All the towns around it are, like, little... Like, the biggest one is Jiakua, which is, like... What, a port? It's like an entry port. Like, this wouldn't even rank in the top 20 cities of Khajistan before Diablo 2. And if you think about it, if you go back from the events of Diablo to the events of Diablo 4, we're looking at about, I think, close to about 100 to 120 years, all told. Like, if you go from each game. In that 120 years, most of the human race died, and many civilizations got utterly destroyed. Like, when we last saw, oh bloody heck! It's the city from Diablo 3 Act 5, Westmarch.
Westmarch. Yep.
When we last see Westmarch, a moron just assassinated the king, thinking he'd get to take over, and then angels basically blew up half the city and killed most of the people. That's before Malthiel Black Deaths everyone. He pulls half their souls out. Is there even a kingdom there anymore? Like, is Condorus basically just a few fishing villages and farming towns now? Like, what? We don't even know what that continent looks like right now. So it's quite possible that in terms of what gold is actually doing in the Diablo universe as of Diablo 4, it might be one of those cases where literally there's enough wealth buried that it would be totally easy, if you were willing to risk getting disemboweled and eaten by whatever the heck is out there, to find tens of thousands of gold pieces. Like, another way to put this is, who is minting gold right now?
Mm-hmm.
Is the church, is the Cathedral of Light minting gold? Because there's no, the Fractured Peaks don't have a nation other than the Cathedral of Light. There's no central authority. There's no over king. There's no even king. The Fractured Peaks don't even have a nation name. You know, they just call themselves the Fractured Peaks. The Dry Steps technically has a name. It just, they don't use it there. And the kings of that area are gone. They've been, you know, literally turned into soup pots for the soup made out of them. So they're not doing any minting. And if you find gold coins, they are probably from the previous century. Oh yeah,
they have to be.
Yeah. Cause I mean, even Chaldeum's not going to be doing anything. Kedjistan as a whole, there might be a mint left in Giyakua, but I don't think so. And Hazawar, I mean, why would they be?
But again, like and those nations are dealing with other things, right? Like they don't mm-hmm. really necessarily care about the minting of money
they can do what they need with barter, right? Yeah, absolutely. They've got the other problems.
And metals are better put towards, instead of making currency or coin, patching armor, patching, you know, weapons.
Which you're not going to do with gold anyway.
No, but you are.
But you might use it for ritual stuff.
But even without the gold, like, you might find other coin too, because one could assume that there was once silver and copper or other precious metals used in currency and bartering as well.
And that's another thing to think about. Considering the Cathedral of Light's only been around this time for about 50 years, that's some fancy ass, like, you know, stuff on the ground in front of the cathedral, isn't it?
Oh yeah, they use you can see it's a lot of their inlays, a lot of their iconography seems to be made out of the glittering gold.
Yeah, so they're definitely using this stuff. And we know there's like a lot of the dungeons you go to are the ruins of previously inhabited places.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes sense that when you go there, you find money there. You know, it may not be the case that a bug out in the Fractured Peaks on a hill, I don't think they give a lot of money. Like, I honestly feel like the gold value of their bodies could well just be the value of their physical bodies, like the components that contained within. Like, if you go into town and sell the shells to an alchemist, if we just streamline that. Instead of you having to carry back all the garbage, the game just gives you the money.
Yeah.
You know,
I believe that's a more accurate representation.
But in terms of, like, what gold is doing, what is a gold coin really worth? A gold coin is worth the value of the metal, and that's about it. Because there's nobody backing it. There's nobody saying, you know, gold, this gold coin is the currency of our nation and all merchants within the nation, you know, must accept it as tender. For all we know, there are merchants who straight up, and in fact, we know there are merchants who straight up won't take it. Like the mysterious Obols guy.
I was just going to bring that up. Yeah. The Obols people.
So I do think that this is an interesting question. It's not one that I think the game is really particularly thinking about, but it is one that's fun to think about if you like, you know, playing around with ideas. Because yeah, where is the gold even coming from?
Yeah, and I mean, and I would assume, and this is something that I thought about thanks to Daikaiju with this question. I do think that it's all leftovers, because with 90% of humanity gone in that course of the 50 years, right? All you're doing is picking up the pieces. That's all they've been doing. They've been moving into ruins. They've been trying to redo pockets of humanity, yeah, trying to reestablish trade game. Routes. Yeah, it is essentially a Fallout game.
And the thing is, it's like if in a Finn Fallout, instead of bottle caps becoming the new currency, it's like if they just kept using quarters and dimes and nickels. But you know, what was the quarter worth? Well, whatever anyone will take for it. You know, it's kind of like that.
So I think that's going to answer that question for now. We're going to move on to the next one, which comes from our friend Galari. I went into a new dungeon south in the swamp, lore-heavy one, and there was the same type of blood tentacles as the one up north. That got me thinking, are they connected to Lilith? Can they be part of a bigger organism? And if it's the same, how big is it? So for context, as you go through Diablo dungeons or content and things like that, blood is the theme, right? The blood has always been the theme since the very opening cinematic, since we were first revealed the game, where it is by the blood of humans or, you know, depowered Nephilim that Lilith has brought back from her exile to Sanctuary proper. Everything we see revolves around the blood. As Matt has pointed out many, many times, the blood is the key. We see these tentacles that look very fleshy, very organic, very alive in a lot of dungeons, in a lot of places, in a lot of the underground. And what that means, I don't know that we actually know. So, Matt, do you have any theories about what these are? Because I have one, but I don't, I'm not entirely sold on it yet.
The first time you see those tentacles and stuff you're talking about is when you are chasing after Lilith towards the temple, the necropolis of the firstborn. Every dungeon you see them in afterwards is one that is old. Like, it's like the Forbidden City dungeon has them in it. Several others do as well. They're all old. They're all possibly ancient.
Yeah,
possibly the ancients themselves, the Nephilim, the same ones that built these the town. When you are in Diablo 3 in Act 5 and you're chasing after Adria, you go to an ancient Nephilim city that's full of weird tentacles and stuff, just, you know, very similar art style, and you chase Adria down to this pool that she's using, and when you fight her, she starts making giant blood bubbles pop out of the pool.
Mm-hmm.
Which is certainly familiar if you have seen any of the stuff we've seen so far, which makes you wonder, was Adria still working for Diablo at that point, or had she switched paymasters? Considering Diablo himself wasn't in any position to be giving her orders. And that's something to think about when you think about the temple you're talking about is the one that Rathma himself went to talk about his vision. It's the one that Elias followed him to and found out the secret of immortality. So I think it is where Rathma communicated with the being, the serpent, Tregul, whatever you want to call it, that was helping him along on his journey. In many mythological systems in the real world, snakes, ophidians, are a symbol of rebirth.
Mm-hmm.
Because they shed their skins. And a whole new snake comes out, and the old skin is left behind. And that serves as a metaphor for the idea of rebirth. You know, you become something new, something better. I think that you are looking at the shed metaphysical skin of the being that was teaching Rathma. And one of the interesting things is, if you go back to the Book of Cain, the original illustrated book that came out for Diablo 3, in it there is a picture of Rathma as seen by the priests of Rathma, the necromancers. In it, he's a dragon.
Mm-hmm.
He looks, in fact, a lot like the serpent that you meet outside of the Tree of Whispers, an enormous, long, serpentine being. So is that being Rathma? Do you meet Rathma in Diablo 4? Is that him? Let's just put a pin in that for now. But I think that everything you're talking, you see, everything you experience when you go to those places, all that stuff is essentially like, it's kind of like the objective correlative of what's happening. It is the decaying remnants of the world that died when the World Stone died. It's this junk. And to a degree, it's also a revelation that the place you're in is not fully real in the same way that Sanctuary is. Like, think about all the stuff the ancients could do. Like, they could move mountains. They, you know, it's talked about over and over again. They were like gods. And you can't, what, you know, a god, to quote another game, a god is a verb. You know, a god isn't just someone stands around and talks about what a god they are. A god is a verb. Esu, the ancient who created the Zan Esu clan, who was one of the first mage clans, the Zan Esu learned to reach inside themselves and, through their own connection to the world around them, pull forth raw elemental force. They just made it happen. And they did that because of the gift that they got from being, you know, being what they were, being connected to every aspect of existence.
Yeah. So, and
look at the Druids under Fiacla Giar. I promise I'll shut up after this, but the Druids under Fiacla Giar learned how to reach out to the world itself and say, you know, what you're doing is unbalanced. It's disorganized. In a way, druids and necromancers are very much like the same thing, but for different states of existence. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
So go ahead.
No, I was going to say along the same lines, like I was thinking about this in terms of what is sanctuary? Sanctuary is a land or a world, a universe, a pocket of the universe that was created using the Eye of Anu, the World Stone. It was used by the combination of powers between the angels and the demons in order to make it manifest, which means it is the most complete potential use of it that we've ever seen, where a being that is of both parts or beings comprised of both parts went together and did it, which is why Sanctuary has persisted where none of the other worlds created with it have. And that's a hill I will die on. I believe that is why it persists. But when you look at it, what does that mean? Worlds created by the power of Anu seem to have a living essence about them. Even the burning hells in the high heavens have sort of like a weirdly organic feel about them. When you go into the hells, what does it look like in every instance that we've gone there? It's fleshy, organic. It's almost as if it's been melded from repurposed bodies, essentially. And the high heavens, if you think about it, are very much the same, except that body just happens to be made out of crystal instead.
And light.
What if what we're seeing isn't necessarily the decay of the being Tra'Ghul or the decay of the world itself?
I meant more like slothed off snake skin. That's where I was going.
Yeah. But what if it's not that? What if this is just the inner workings of the world that we've never seen before? These places that we're going to, these dungeons, these places, especially the one in the swamp, especially the city of the first ones, I'm sorry, the tomb of the Nephilim, which is where all of the Nephilim, the original Nephilim, were supposed to be entombed or interred. These are deep places that we've never been to. These are places tied to sort of the fabric of reality in their respective places. That dungeon in the swamp, we talk about this. The swamp itself might be a pocket dimension. And if that is such, when we start diving into the deep places and start looking at the connective tissue of it, that might be what this actually is. And it's not necessarily an aspect of Lilith or Mephisto or any of the angels, but of Sanctuary itself. And they can just manipulate it because, well, that's what we've seen them do. That's why we can interact with it. It might also not be visually like that for anybody else. It might only be that way for people that are, I don't want to say enlightened, but closer to their Nephilim. Those are
able to see it.
Yeah, those are able to see it because, again, we go back to this whole, the blood is the key, the blood is the key, the blood is the key. The blood is the key of Sanctuary. Sanctuary is a living entity in and of itself. It has existed and persisted for how long? Through countless tragedies, through all these things that happened. And this may be us physically seeing the metaphorical lifeblood of Sanctuary or the offshoot pocket dimensions, such as the swamps, in a way that others cannot. And I'm wondering if maybe that's part of it. Because towards the end of Diablo 4, there's a question of whether or not your character is a Nephilim. And you very well may be, because you have a divine spark. But also, I don't think any of the NPCs really mention any of the bloody stuff when you're going through them. They mention the demons. They mention the deep dankness of the space. But
some of the most overt signs of it are only seen when you're there.
Or only seen when you're there by yourself.
That's what I mean. Like, when it's just you. Like, what's her name?
When Nayrell accompanies you, none of that stuff is there.
Yeah, Nayrell stops and is like, I got to deal with my mother. You're going to have to go on without me. And that's when you cross over to the actual necropolis of the firstborn. And that's when you start seeing, and some of that's clearly influenced by Lilith as well. Like, Lilith has created these tumors in the structures around you.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You have to go cut them out. So that's there too. But if anyone could do that, Lilith should be able to do that, since she's one of the two people that created the world. But also, to go back to what you were saying and to look at it from a slightly different angle, Pandemonium.
Mm-hmm.
In Diablo 3, when you're running around Pandemonium, It is a rocky, inhospitable, barren place, right? But you end up going inside all sorts of tunnels and holes, and there's those giant entities that burst out of it. And inside, it's winding tunnels and pathways and fire. It's like halfway to hell, but it's often described as scar tissue. Like in the original cosmological description of Pandemonium, it's actually called the scar tissue of the battle between the Dying Warrior.
Yeah, that's right.
And it looks like a big scab. It looks like a scar on existence. And so that's something to think about when you're thinking about this idea, whether or not it's like some kind of, I still think right now, my theory is still based on the idea that you are looking at scar tissue. When you are looking at those tentacles, you're looking at like the snake skin being shed. Or another way to put it would be, you're looking at previous times the snake skin was shed. Because the world has been changing and growing this whole time, you know, and it hasn't always been the way it was. There was the Mage Wars, there was the Sin War. Lots of stuff has happened to Sanctuary.
Lots of scars.
Like a tree that has rings inside of it. You know, when you cut through across the tree, you can actually see, okay, here's a growth ring, here's a growth ring, here's a growth ring. I think there is a certain element of that too, which is why I find the Tree of Whispers so fascinating. Because the Tree of Whispers does seem to be a deliberately alien presence. It's not of heaven or hell. It doesn't seem to be particularly of Sanctuary. It certainly isn't like the something the druids would talk to, but it is something the witches make pacts with. And it kind of feels like a mirror to the druidic thing. Druids, necromancers, and witches, I hope witches become playable at some point, they all seem to do the similar kind of thing in different areas.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that the Tree of Whispers and witches work seems very much to dance in the interplay between conflicting existences in a way that's fascinating, that I would love to hear more about.
Well, hopefully that answers that question. We could talk about that for a little bit longer, I am confident. But I think we're going to move on to the next question here, which is a bit of a rant, bit of a question. And this one comes from Horax. I just finished the main story. Some mild spoilers ahead if you haven't finished the game.
Yeah, I'll give you a quick countdown. 3, 2, 1, spoil.
I just finished the main story, and I'm unhappy about having to kill Lilith. The story did nothing to make me dislike her, but reinforced that the angels are just as much of blanks as the demons. They hate humanity and want us gone, too. Tyriel could have spoken to Anarius, but they didn't because they don't like Sanctuary. Lilith wanted to end the conflict and win. She wanted to rule over it all, but at no point did she want to kill all humans. Both other sides did. I know there's more, and they're going to do expansions with the Primes, but I feel the better call would have been to have her flee our character and chase the stone. Continue and maybe show a reason to kill her other than demon bad, despite the fact that demon is the mother of humanity. One thing, Tyriel doesn't speak to Anarius, not because he hates Sanctuary. He doesn't hate Sanctuary. As a matter of fact, he's probably one of the only ones that doesn't hate Sanctuary. He gets called back.
I had a conversation about this with Liz, and I wish Liz was here, because then she could just tell you about it, but I'll give you the bare bones. It isn't just Tyriel amongst the angels of the Injurious Council, and other angels for that matter, who are conflicted or even like thinking, you know, these beings are not just half demon. The other half is angel.
Mm-hmm.
We shouldn't be treating them like this. In both Faith and Hope, not Faith, which one is it? I always get them wrong. It's Fate and Hope, Auriel and Ithariel. They were both pretty pro-human. Like the Nephilim showed up and they were like, yes, good. This is good. I think Ithariel's the Fate one, or is it Auriel?
Auriel.
Auriel straight up says, I can't see your fate at all. And it's great. You know, we have fate. We know exactly what's going to happen to us, but you don't have that. You can choose what happens to you. You can cause what happens to you. You know, maybe not all of it, because every one of you can do it. So there's lots of back and forth there, but that's great compared to us. They were excited to see us. So it isn't all angels, but the ones that do hate us do. Like, you know, Imperius is looking for a reason.
He always Imperius was.
Loved to wipe out humanity. He has always wanted to.
Well, and to be fair, it's because we are a weapon.
Yeah, and he wants it gone, so it's not used against them.
Mm-hmm.
Tyriel originally didn't view us any better than Imperius did. In fact, he hated humanity so much that Imperius thought he'd be a slam dunk to vote to wipe them out. It was watching the events of the Sin War. It was watching what a Nephilim did, Odysseus, the sacrifice he made that made Tyriel realize it's not just to view all of these beings as if their origins are all that matter about them. It's not just to destroy them before they've done anything. And that's, to me, that goes back to what I was saying before about how contact with an actual, real, moving, living world changes them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think that's fair, first off, the view of angels here. It's certainly true that there are a lot of angels who treat humans like cattle, and there are quite a few of them that would be totally okay with killing us. We just saw that. Angels have a lot of bad apples, but they have more good apples than the demons do. There are very few rebellious demons that want to be good and help people. I mean, and you're talking about Lilith. Lilith, you know, sure, she wants to rule, but she doesn't want to kill all humans. No, but she did stab a soul stone into Yoren's forehead, knowing it would destroy him in agony, just because she knew that the thrill of getting to use the son of his enemy's body would mean that the charred Duke would totally agree with her plan.
And not only that, but like, she also is very, she doesn't really care. She can make more, right? Like, that's, we don't necessarily matter. And she sort of says this even in her confrontation with Anarius, right? It's, you know, and even when we're trapped in the scrying eye, the sightless eye realm with her, you know, looming over us, it's, you know, many will die. Yes, that's absolutely accurate. But the strong will survive, and then there will be more, right? It's because that strong will then be able to stand against the heavens and hells, and then will reproduce, and their offspring will continue to be as powerful as they were, and so on and so forth. She doesn't.
The world's not there to stop them.
Yep, exactly. The world stone's gone. There's nothing to turn the power off again. And in fact, the power's been slowly creeping back this entire time, or at least we see evidence of that. But like, she doesn't really care. She could have saved humanity. The demons that follow in her wake are not, you know, sparing us. You go through and you're seeing them tear apart the children of Sanctuary. You're seeing mm-hmm. them kill people. These are demons sworn to her. So
yeah, they just want to be on the winning side, and she just wants to win.
Yes. That is what I think you should keep in mind with it, is she is the game actually does quite a bit to make you not like her if you pay attention. It is very easy to ignore that.
Yeah, yeah. But even if you liking her outside, you can admire Lilith for a lot of things and still realize that at the end of the day, she is no better than the people that, you know, she's not better than Mephisto. She's not better than Anarius. She's not worse than them either, but why should humanity bow to any of them? The real message, I think, is of all people, the true hero and visionary of the Diablo series is Zoltan Kuhl.
Yeah.
Who himself is a psychotic evil person, but who understands that angels and demons do not care about us for the most part. They do not have our best interests at heart, and they will use us as pawns in their eternal war unless we stop them. And he's the one who never lies when you interact with him. There is never a lie that comes out of his mouth. He always tells the truth. He always says, you know, I what I want is to continue my research. I want to like make an even better soulstone and imprison all of them. I want to like rule this world to keep it safe. You know, he's not a good person. And it's also not a good idea to have that guy in charge. But at the same time, do you know what I'm saying? Like, in the end of the day, the best move is the one Lorath is suggesting, where F all of them. You know, we definitely don't trust Lilith, and we don't let Lilith do her plan. We're certainly not going to trust Mephisto and do anything he wants us to do. And we're sure as heck not going to let Anarius run the show, because none of these people care about us, and none of them are stable. Like, you know, Anarius is, you can feel really bad for Anarius and still think he's an utter jerk.
Oh yeah.
Like, to quote Lorath again, you know, no one ever tells you that, you know, spending thousands of years being tortured in hell makes you a bit of an arse. But, you know, yeah, Lilith is a very complicated and interesting character. And she's not human. and she does not have our mindset. So that has to be kept in mind.
Mm-hmm.
But it is fascinating to see how she is not a stock, you know, she's not stock evil here who just wants to destroy for the sake of it. She has a plan and she wants to execute it.
And also the other thing that I'd like to point out here too is you're making the assumption that she's dead. And we don't know. We don't know that she's dead because how many times have we dead-deaded Mephisto or Andariel or Duriel or Diablo himself? Diablo's
talking three times now.
Yeah. And yet they always seem to come back. And we are not a fully powered up Nephilim yet. We can't control reality. We can definitely influence things and we definitely have the ability to see things in a way that others don't. But we're not, you know, we're not Mendel. We're not the Nephilim of old. We're not
even the one from Diablo 3 yet.
Yeah, we are still nascent at best. And so when we defeat her in hell, mind you, in her father's domain of hatred, where we have just scooped out his essence and shoved it into a soul stone, so he's not there anymore, or at least whatever collected essences he had there are not there anymore, who's to say she doesn't reform? Who's to say she doesn't reform more powerful than before in her father's domain? She is the daughter of hatred.
Mm-hmm. And for that matter, we don't see her, like, when she does the whole thing, she just vanishes in, like, a cloud of those rose petals. You know, who's to say that's dead? Maybe she just moved herself somewhere where we weren't and you know, got back to re-knitting together. You know, it's not like she couldn't. You know, demons tend to do that regardless. I mean, mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd be great. I mean, from our perspective, sure, you know, it looked like she died, but, you know, who knows what that even looks like.
But, I mean, that's also the whole point of why we were trying to forge the Soul Stone in the first place.
Yeah, the reason we still have Soul Stones, you know, as Liz pointed out, they're a terrible weapon that don't work, but they're the best option we have.
Because you can't just kill a demon.
Yeah.
And, like, the only reason that we were dealing with, like, not a fully reformed Diablo or a fully reformed Mephisto or Belial at this point is because they were in a stone that was shattered and their essences are sort of split. Right.
And they have to recollect literally what we're told Mephisto is doing.
Yes. And what didn't we do with Lilith? We didn't shove her into a stone and then scatter her essence to the corners of all creation. No, we just,
go ahead.
As I say, we just turned her to stone ? We just beat her down till she expended all of her power, which I think that's more accurate. I think that she's not actually dead. Her battery just ran out.
I want to remind people of the whole thing we were trying to do in Diablo 2, which was to beat the three primevals, get their soul stones, take their soul stones to Pandemonium Fortress, and shatter them. Why? If what is the reason to do that? Is it going to kill them? It certainly doesn't seem like that was what it would do. Would Tyriel necessarily know that? Maybe not, but he is an angel. He probably has at least some idea of what these things do, considering he's the one who taught the Horadrim how to use them. And the reason that Malthiel was able to use the Black Soul Stone is because Malthiel is the one who studied the World Stone in the first place. He's Heaven's version of Mephisto, in a way. Wisdom is the guy who thinks. So he was the one who studied everything. So what were they going for with this? What was the gambit? Was the gambit to do exactly what we see has happened to them in Diablo 4? When in Diablo 3, when the Black Soul Stone is shattered and their essences fly throughout creation, was that the goal?
I say yes, but I've been saying that since we talked about this during the Diablo episodes. Again, mm-hmm. Go back and listen to them. It makes the most amount of sense because their influence is still seen everywhere. They're not gone.
Yeah, and that's the thing to think about. You pointed out that there's the planes of hatred or the fields of hatred. And the fields of hatred are basically completely suffused with the essence of Mephisto from stuff he did. And we don't, like, you know, why is that? Is that because that's where his power has been collecting to be returned? As long as hatred exists, does the Lord of Hatred exist? And think about what all this stuff means in terms of what we're going to see in the future. Like, Baal and Diablo are going to come back. And so are, you know, Belial and Asmodan and Duriel and Andariel, who have kicked it in, like, multiple Diablo games now.
Mm-hmm.
And they just always come back. Because suffering and pain and sin and lies are very commonplace.
Mm-hmm.
As long as those things keep happening, so will they.
Yeah, I mean, you can literally just go to any of the camps. People still live in terror. People still are, there's still this drive for destruction. They still lie to each other. There's still this burning hatred. Like, you can do these side quests when you're in the Dry Steppes and between the Iron Wolves and the Bandits. And that is a heck of a quest line when you talk about portraying all of those evils in, you know, living form. Because it's there, all of it, between the two of them. There's so much going on here that I don't, again, I don't think it's genuine to say that Lilith is dead, because I don't think she can die. Not for as long as Sanctuary exists, not for as long as the Burning Hells and High Heavens exist. Do I believe that they can truly die? So, or until a Nephilim comes along and uncreates them, like, you know, a certain one did in the Sin War books.
Yeah.
But I think that's going to do it, unless you have any other parting thoughts for us, Matt.
Oh my God, do I have other parting thoughts? No, I'm going to stop myself from saying them, because there's just so much, man.
There is, and it's a game that keeps giving it to us, and we're going to see more in the future, especially as we've been told that seasonal content will have story content. We're told that there are expansions in the works. There's a lot more to come. Diablo is now nowhere near done and finished, and there's still more to unravel.
Werewolf, werewolf, werewolf.
Werewolf, werewolf, werewolf. Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/BlizzardWatch. Your continued support means that this podcast signing community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the Q&A ads, free site experience. If you have any questions for us, if you want to ask us more Diablo questions, feel free to send those in. podcast@blizzardwatch.com. Specify what show it's for. You can also hit us up on Discord. We have the Q&A podcast questions channel for everybody to drop their questions in. And if you are a Patreon supporter, as a way of saying thank you for helping us keep the lights on, we have the Patreon Q&A podcast questions channel, where we tend to look first for these questions. Just a little extra bonus. But with that, folks, we'll see you next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.